Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for August 8th, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, an editorial on science in Muslim countries, the brain signature of borderline personality disorder, and a feature on careers in geology. All this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
The Muslim world should be poised for a remarkable scientific explosion.
Ismail Sarikaldin is director of the Library of Alexandria, member of the Egyptian Senate, co-chair of the African Biotechnology Panel, and vice president of the Academy of Sciences of the Developing World.
Indeed, there are some very high-profile projects in the Gulf with massive state-of-the-art facilities for science and serious efforts elsewhere. But even with more than $1 trillion in cash and the population of over 1 billion people, the observed reality is that Muslim countries tend to spend less on science research compared to other countries at the same income scale. And when funding is and has been available, the results in terms of scientific papers, citations, and patents are disappointingly low. Why? I believe it is because we are witnessing an increasingly intolerant social milieu that is driven by self-appointed guardians of religious correctness, who inject their narrow interpretation of religion into all public debates. Rejecting rationality or evidentiary approaches, these religious zealots increasingly force dissenting voices into silence and into conformity. Of course, such zealots are not limited to the Muslim world. In the United States, battles over evolution and creationism continue to rage. Yet, it was our Muslim forefathers who first held up the torch of rationality, tolerance, and the advancement of knowledge throughout the dark ages of medieval Europe. For example, in the 10th century, Ibn al-Haytham laid down the rules of the empirical approach, describing how the scientific method should operate through observation, measurement, experiment, and conclusion. Likewise, in the 13th century, Ibn al-Nafis urged people to test contrarian views, writing that indeed horrible things may be true and familiar and praised things may prove to be wrong. Such is the Muslim tradition that we must revive if current scientific projects are to bear the fruit that 1 billion Muslims need and that the world has a right to expect of us. Because, as important as money and projects are, science requires much more. In particular, science requires freedom. Freedom to inquire, freedom to challenge, freedom to think, freedom to imagine the unimagined. And the content of the scientific work is what is discussed, not the person who produced it, regardless of the color of their skin, or the god they choose to worship, or the ethnic group they were born into, or their gender. These societal values are worth defending, not just to promote the pursuit of science, but to have a better and more humane society. The scientists practicing in the Muslim world are a part of this international scientific community, which increasingly is a truly global cultural force. They must help create the space of freedom necessary for the practice of science, even more than the availability of money. Because it is these values of science that can unleash the full measure of their talent and their genius. But first, all of this requires liberating the mind from the tyranny of intolerance, bigotry, and fear, and opening the doors to free inquiry, tolerance, and imagination. I'm Ismail Saragidin.
Ismail Saragidin on science in Muslim countries. You can read the full version of his editorial in this week's Science. Also this week in Science, stretchy electronics. Tsuyoshi Sekitani and colleagues have designed a rubbery material with electronic properties, which may be useful for creating devices that could be mounted anywhere, including curved surfaces or in movable parts, such as the joints of a robot's arm. The material is a carbon nanotube elastomer composite incorporated into an active matrix array of organic transistors and can be biaxially stretched 70% without mechanical or electrical damage. Read more about it online at www.scienceexpress.org.
This is Nancy Goff, editor of Science Signaling. We are now accepting original research submissions for publication starting September 2008. The journal formerly known as Science's SDKE is devoted to the topic of cellular signal transduction. To learn more, go to www.sciencesignaling.org.
Borderline personality disorder is a serious mental illness afflicting some 2% of adults, mostly young women. According to the U.S. National Institute of Mental Health, patients with borderline personality disorder often need extensive mental health services and account for 20% of psychiatric hospitalizations. Although the causes are unknown, new research suggests the illness may arise partly through abnormalities in a brain region involved in cooperation and social exchange. In a paper in this week's Science, Brooks King Cassis, Reed Montague, and colleagues report this brain signature of borderline personality disorder and the implications for patients with this and other mental conditions. I spoke with King Cassis and Montague from Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. Here's Reed Montague.
We used a social interaction game to probe a personality disorder called borderline personality disorder, which is characterized by an inability to maintain stable relationships. This is an economically contrived game, so it has mathematical solutions that allow us to eavesdrop on those parts of your brain and the signals in your brain that control interacting with another person.
What we found was
Brooks King Cassis is lead author.
That individuals with borderline personality disorder, it's not just that they show a brain signature that differs from healthy control subjects, but really it's specifically about the computations around social perceptions and how they're reading signals from social partners. But with this same structure used to make decisions back to another human agent were completely intact.
Generally, what characterizes borderline personality disorder? Reed?
It's a problem of being able to do two things. One, basically control your emotional reactions to things. And another problem, which probably interacts deeply with this, which is your incapacity to maintain stable relationships. There are a lot of other features of it. It's high correlation with mood disorders. But of course, when you can't maintain stable relationships, how well does the rest of your life go, right?
So, Brooks, how are these characteristics of borderline personality disorder exhibited when people with the disorder are playing this game?
So, essentially, this is a game in which one person is required to trust another person in order for both players to sort of benefit from sort of mutual cooperation. And in this game, and many like it, when you play it in an iterated way, back and forth, there's a lot of opportunities for cooperation both to build but also to break down. Basically, one person is given $20 to start with, and they can choose to give some amount of that to their partner. If they choose to give all of it to them, that $20 is automatically tripled to be $60. So the trustee potentially receives $60 and then split that $60 with their partner. On the other hand, if the investor sends them a small amount of money, say only $5, that triples to $15. So between the two of them, the best way to sort of cooperate in this game is for the investor to send a large amount of that investment, have that tripled, and then try and share it equitably. But it's difficult to sort of for both players to earn a return on their investment if the investor only sends a small amount of that initial endowment.
So those with borderline personality disorder were not sending that investment back?
Yeah, so when those with borderline personality disorder got a small investment, they essentially would sort of say they got the investor had sent $5, that tripled to $15. Those with borderline personality disorder would be much more likely to keep that $15 as opposed to send back a large amount of that. Healthy controls, on the other hand, if they get $15, would likely return all 15 of those dollars in order to incentivize their partner to send more on a subsequent round.
So, Reed, with cooperation broken, how does one repair the relationship in the game? Is that through sending more back, being more generous?
Right. It's the way you repair cooperation in normal social settings where you're not necessarily trading money. You may trade any kind of social gestures. You do something generous. You do something slightly or greatly over-generous. So, the interesting thing about cooperation is this. We know from the last 50 years of ecological research and behavioral economics that cooperative strategies in animals, species that aren't like us even, cooperation will break down in a noisy environment. And by noisy, I mean this. If I don't exactly know you very well, and I don't know exactly what to expect out of you, I have to start with some sort of assumed model of you. And I may send a signal like, I'm going to send you some money, and I expect that you expect $10, so I send you 10, but maybe you expected 20, right? Cooperation breaks down. So the question using a game like this wasn't whether cooperation broke, but once broken, how it will get repaired. So here's how it gets repaired. You do something, all of a sudden the two of us break down in cooperation, you're sending very little, then there's very little for me to even send back, and so I re-engage it by sending a little too much back one time. And it signals to you, oh yeah, I'm more trustworthy and I want to rebuild cooperation. So on the one hand, one person has to build a model of their partner in order to know how much to send, right? How trustworthy is that person? On the receiving end, which is where we had the borderline personality disorders patients playing, they have to know the meaning of that gesture that comes over and how to make that gesture sustain cooperation or repair it once it's broken. And that's what they couldn't do. The interesting thing about the borderline personality disorder subjects was this. They weren't completely broken in this domain. They know what is fair. What we saw in their brains was that the perception of the gesture by the person that sends them the money, that's the thing that's off. When they make gestures, when they send low amounts of money back, their brain says, ooh, that looks unfair to me. But when they're receiving these things, it's like there's a social perception problem only on the receipt end.
So this is the brain signature.
Right. And this is where a specific region of the brain was able to report this to it, called the anterior insula. And this region of the brain is known to respond to norm violations across a vast array of dimensions. In other words, this region of your brain sort of says, this is what you should be doing, and there's a big deviation in that. So for example, when you're really thirsty, it says, oh, you should have this much hydration, but you're really thirsty, so your anterior insula goes off. When the webbing in your fingers is pinched, it says, this is how much pain you should put up with, but it's going beyond that now, and it goes off. When you're monitoring your heart rate and you get anxious, this area goes off. But it also goes off in a systematic way for a monetary fairness game. If you sort of amalgamate all that information and think, what is the anterior insula reporting on? One hypothesis is, it's kind of reporting on norm deviations across all these dimensions. How ought you to behave? How ought you to keep your body sustained, etc.? And it's interesting that evolution has apparently reused this region of the brain that's monitoring sort of your insides, right, to deal with social exchange with other people.
Brooks, mm-hmm. Will this research then help in the diagnosis of borderline personality disorder or some other clinical or practical application?
Yeah, so borderline personality disorder, like many of the personality disorders, have many overlapping features. And so sort of the category boundaries of what is or is not borderline PD has been a matter of controversy for years. But we haven't had ways of really characterizing and identifying neural signatures of many of the symptoms associated with borderline personality disorder and other psychiatric disorders similar to BPD. So I think that this approach, using game theoretic experimental paradigms to characterize social interactions, will help us to both understand and characterize the disorder, but also develop and target both behavioral and pharmacologic treatments.
Reed?
We have characterized the behavioral response of the borderlines and the healthies, because we've done this in hundreds, and this is the largest fMRI study in the world, if you compare it with our normal database. And we've probably scanned over 600 people on this. So we really know how people behave on this. And so we have computer programs that play adaptively like healthy people and borderlines. This provides for us a tool that we might use to assess outcome and even in diagnosis, right? It says we can have a computer agent play you and decide where you play on the axis from totally healthy to totally borderline personality disorder patient. And we see this approach as being able to be extended into other domains, right? I mean, we can turn what used to be just behavioral descriptions into numbers.
Brooks King-Cassis and Reed Montague, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Brooks King-Cassis is lead author, and Reed Montague is senior author of a paper on the rupture and repair of cooperation in borderline personality disorder. Read the paper in this week's Science. Also this week in Science, the chemical makeup of fingerprints. Damian Ifa and colleagues have developed a new technique that reveals in high detail the chemical compounds that make up fingerprints. The technique, called desorption electrospray ionization, involves spraying a solvent onto a fingerprinted surface and then analyzing the droplets that scatter off the print. Forensic scientists may use the technique to help distinguish among overlapping prints and pick up small amounts of drugs, compounds from explosives, or identifying metabolites, whose presence may signal other processes happening inside the body. Read all about it in this week's Science.
Despite tight economic times, careers in the geosciences are booming.
Science Careers contributing editor Kate Travis edits a special section in this week's Science on careers in geosciences.
The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics estimates that the number of geoscience jobs will grow by 22% by 2016, more than double the projected growth rate for all occupations. Even now, new geosciences graduates are finding it pretty easy to find jobs. Cindy Martinez is a workforce specialist at the American Geological Institute.
It's a great time to be graduating with a degree in the geosciences because there is functionally no unemployment right now of geoscientists. Right now, there's such a demand for people who understand something about these big societal issues that we're facing with water, energy resources, natural hazards, you name it.
And the research and industry that surrounds these big societal issues involve a broad array of career paths. Petroleum geology is a major one. More than 40% of geoscientists in the United States are employed in the petroleum industry, including Kira Diaz-Tushman.
I work for BP in a segment called North American Gas. I look at analog fields, I look at other well logs, and try to make correlations and try to make the case that an area that has not been drilled is prospective.
Diaz-Tushman says she first considered a career as a geologist in high school when she heard a report on the radio.
We were listening to National Public Radio in the U.S., and there was a story about how, I believe it was like 2010 or 2020, that all the geologists that work for the USGS would be retiring. We got into this conversation about jobs after school, and I was like, well, I guess geology is one place where there will be jobs when I graduate.
Diaz-Tushman went on to get a bachelor's and a master's degree before landing her current job at BP.
Every part that we do is like a little project where you say, okay, well, I have this bit of data here and I have this bit of data on this other side. And I know that technically these should go right through this area that I'm looking at, but can I prove before I put a drill bit to the ground that there will be oil and gas there? And it's all about kind of making the case. It's all about building up the information that you have around you, making assumptions, and then testing your hypothesis with a drill bit. It's very much a science.
Just as geologists are essential for unlocking the world's energy reserves, geologists like Rochelle Allen King also play a critical role in studying and maintaining the world's water resources.
The concerns about water are not going away.
Allen King is a hydrogeology professor at the University at Buffalo in New York.
There's a big role for people who know about hydrogeology as the demand goes up for clean water, as clean water maybe becomes a scarcer resource and recognized as a more precious resource.
Kurt Zeiler is one of those hydrogeology experts. He works with the consulting firm Amec Geomatrix.
I do a broad array of things, mostly related to quantitative hydrogeology. I do a lot of computer modeling of groundwater flow and transport.
Zeiler says what drew him to the field were the broad social implications of the work.
Being able to do science and do work on the ground that is socially relevant, there's a lot of both water resources and remediation work in hydrogeology that ends up being socially relevant and affecting people's lives.
But while jobs abound for geoscientists in industry, those on the academic career path are finding the job search more challenging. Again, Cindy Martinez from the American Geological Institute.
What we're hearing from the academic community is that as faculty retire, they're not being replaced. They're not getting a new full-time tenure-track faculty to replace that person who's retired in a lot of cases. But overall, we're seeing a drop in the number of total full-time faculty slots.
In particular, hydrogeology professor Rochelle Allen King says there's more competition for fewer federal grant dollars.
It's gotten harder and harder to get grants, I think. I see it becoming more and more competitive for my junior colleagues because there's more and more people applying, and the budgets haven't gone up in like 15 years. So it's hard, but that doesn't mean that people that have good and interesting ideas aren't doing interesting and cool stuff either. So it's hard, but I see people being successful even at the junior level.
For people who do want to go into academic research in the geosciences, a PhD is the preferred degree. But Alan King says it's different for industry.
If you want to go to work in consulting or industry, a master's degree is just the right preparation for most jobs. If you intend to go for a master's or PhD, the thing to do is to get really good basic sciences, so basic physics, basic chemistry, basic biology, basic geology, earth materials, and math, including differential equations.
And Cindy Martinez from the American Geological Institute adds that the high demand for top talent in geosciences industries means high salaries, too.
Salaries for geoscientists are great right now. Bachelor's geoscience graduates are earning a little over $30,000 a year. If you're coming out with a master's degree, you can earn a much, much higher salary, both in the environmental industry and in the oil and gas industry. In oil and gas, some of the starting salaries are up in the $80,000 range for someone with a master's degree.
Job analysts are cautious about making predictions about the current surge in jobs and salaries. And the oil industry in particular has a history of crashes and layoffs that geologists wish they could forget. But at the same time, the rising interest in the environment and the ever-growing need for energy and water resources suggests that the job market will be rock solid for the years to come. For Science Careers, this is Kate Travis.
Read more about the geology job market and careers in petroleum and hydrogeology in this week's Science and online at sciencecareers.org. Finally today, science news writer Rachel Zelkowitz is sitting in for David Grimm to talk about the latest science stories on Science Now. Hi, Rachel.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, we've got a full lineup. We're looking at a renewed debate over a previously discredited treatment for cancer therapy. Secondly, just how quickly the world froze over. And finally, we're looking at a new tool that police are using to catch elephant poachers.
Well, let's start with a discredited treatment for cancer. It's gotten some new credit, it sounds like.
Sort of. Basically, we're talking about vitamin C. This is the same stuff, ascorbic acid, that's in your oranges, orange juice, all the citrus fruits your mom always told you to eat. Now, in the 1970s, people started to believe that possibly taking vitamin C could help treat cancer. However, some studies by the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota discredited that, saying there was no benefit from consuming massive doses of vitamin C. Now people are saying that there might have been a problem with the way the Mayo Clinic did their study.
What problem?
Well, your body has limits on how much vitamin C you can absorb. Your intestines will only let so much of it through. But if you receive vitamin C via IV, so via injection, actually into your bloodstream, you can get a lot more of it in there.
Is it dangerous to have much vitamin C in your bloodstream?
There's some debate. Previous studies have shown that it can be a little bit dangerous. However, in the current study, the researchers found that the dose of vitamin C they used was tolerated by humans with no adverse side effects.
What does vitamin C do to cancer cells?
Okay, so vitamin C triggers a chemical reaction that produces large amounts of hydrogen peroxide in the fluid that surrounds your cells. Now, normal cells, so your blood cells and normal muscle cells, etc., have some mechanism that prevents them from being damaged by this hydrogen peroxide. Some cancer cells, however, don't have that mechanism. And when the hydrogen peroxide level gets too high, they actually die.
How effective a treatment is this?
Well, in the tests that researchers recently conducted, they found that lab mice who were implanted with cancer tumors experienced 41 to 50% less growth in their tumors when they received high doses of vitamin C via injection than the control mice that didn't receive any vitamin C.
Now, vitamin C is, of course, already approved by the FDA. Will doctors start implementing this right away then, or is there some concern over this treatment option?
Well, at this point, they've only done tests in cultures and in mice, and there's a long way to go before this can be approved as an actual bona fide treatment for humans with cancer. So the next step is doing human trials. So the point is not to go out and request massive doses of vitamin C because they still have a lot more work to be done. But scientists are saying it's worth looking at this again.
Well, from high doses of vitamin C to treat cancer to high winds driving rapid climate change. Tell me about when the world froze over.
Well, it's actually Europe that froze over. And it happened 13 millennia ago. It plunged into a deep freeze that lasted 1,300 years. And scientists have known for a long time that it happened fairly quickly. But they didn't know until very recently just how quickly it happened and why it happened.
Some new evidence, then.
Yes, absolutely. By looking at sediment deposits from a lake in Germany, which is actually in the crater of an ancient volcano, they were able to determine that the freeze happened in a little more than one single year.
What had been the previous thought about how this sudden cold spell came about?
Well, previously, scientists thought that there was some change in ocean currents. There's a current in the Atlantic Ocean that brings relatively warm climate to the European continent, and they thought that possibly something in that current had shut off or changed direction, and that's what changed the climate in Europe.
And this new hypothesis?
Well, now they're thinking that it might have actually been a series of strong winds that produced the sudden drop in temperature for Europe.
How much of a temperature drop are we talking about here?
Well, 5 degrees centigrade, which doesn't sound like a lot, but over an entire continent, it makes a big difference. They also estimated that at that time period, the average temperature for the globe dropped 3 degrees Celsius.
What evidence is there for this wind hypothesis exactly from this lake?
Well, while looking at the lake, the team looked at the sediment record. And what they found is that there's a particular kind of sediment that normally forms at the bottom of a lake when the water is calm, so there's no oxygen circulating through the lake. But when they examined this lake in western Germany, they didn't find evidence of that sediment, which led them to believe that the water must have been churning. What would churn the water? Very strong winds.
Is it possible that the cessation of this warming ocean current had brought about these strong winds? Or are scientists saying, no, the winds could have been brought about by something else?
At this point, they're not really sure. It could have been brought about by something else, but they're going to need to do some more testing to determine that. But the impact it's having right now is it's forcing scientists in the climate community to question their dogma about what exactly could cause changes in climate across the world.
Well, from shifting winds driving climate change to the shifty practice of black market dealings in ivory, what is this technique that police are using to catch elephant poachers?
Well, it's familiar to anyone who enjoys watching crime shows on TV. It's DNA testing.
Of elephants?
Well, of the ivory that police impound once they catch poachers when they get to their final destinations.
What are they comparing this DNA evidence against?
They have databases of DNA evidence from ranges of elephants across Africa. So by examining the DNA they find in the ivory collected, they can determine from what elephant herd or the general region from where the ivory was taken.
Give us an example of how this has been employed.
So in May 2006, law enforcement officers seized ivory in Hong Kong and small bits of ivory in Cameroon. By using DNA analysis, they were able to trace both of these shipments of ivory back to the border between Gabon and Congo.
Right, because before, nobody had any idea where it was coming. They just knew that it had shown up.
Exactly. And so law enforcement officers could only arrest people that showed up at Hong Kong or other ports with the contraband ivory. Now with this new DNA testing, they can determine the origin of the elephants so they can go back to the local governments and have them step up their anti-poaching efforts, having identified the hotspots through this DNA analysis.
Okay, well, thanks, Rachel.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for science now?
Well, we're looking into the creation of stem cells that are specifically geared to produce particular diseases. We're also looking at a new rubber-like circuit that can stretch. So be sure to check out our website.
Science news writer Rachel Zelkowitz sitting in for David Grimm with stories from science's free online daily news site, Science Now. You can catch up on the latest science news at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the August 8th, 2008 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.